Sorry, this is probably not a good time to be starting a whole new topic. In fact, two topics. I'm going to try and keep you awake for the next 45 minutes, and then we're going to hear something about some of the practical issues as a result of the research project that Cornelia was just telling you about. So I'm going to be talking to you about two fairly new directives, to give it its short title, the Directive on the Presumption of Innocence, and then the Directive on Procedural Safeguards for Children. And I will do this, I have 40 minutes, and it means, of course, that I won't be able to deal with it in a great amount of detail, but I hope to acquaint you with some of the major provisions of these two directives. The first of the two directives, that on the presumption of innocence, the transposition date will be in 2018, and the directive on the procedural safeguards for children, the transposition date is 2019, so there is, of course, still a fair amount of time before member states have to undertake the necessary measures to transpose them into domestic law. So we'll deal first with the directive on the presumption of innocence and the right to be present at trial. And this directive, as you can see, was formally adopted earlier this year on the 9th of March. And as I just said, the transposition date is in 2018, the 1st of April, which is probably an opportune date, being certainly in my own country, April Fool's Day. So we'll have to see whether that is borne out in practice across the EU. And maybe we won't be in the EU by then. Who knows? We being the UK. Not me personally, I'd like to stay. But I don't have any Irish connections, I don't have any German connections, and so I'm stuck. Okay. So the directive on strengthening certain aspects of the presumption of innocence and the right to be present at trial. And looking at the impact assessment that was conducted in preparation for consideration of this directive, it had some very interesting things to say about the presumption of innocence, because the presumption of innocence is explicitly there in Article 6.2 of the European Convention on Human Rights and is to be found in most international human rights conventions and of various kinds across the world. So it's regarded as an absolutely essential feature of the criminal process. But what the in the research for the impact assessment, what they concluded is that within Europe, that there is a problem in that the legislation and the constitutions of some member states do not fully comply with the not just the provision in Article 6.2, but the case law of the European Court of Human Rights. But in other states, the law is not the problem, it's the practice which is the problem. And what they went on to say in the impact assessment is that one difficulty in relation to the presumption of innocence results from the very broad way that it is framed in the convention. And so what the directive seeks to do is to give it that very broad framework, more of a structure, and more of a clear structure that can be not only understood and translated into domestic legislation, but also to make it possible, therefore, for judgments to be made about whether any individual jurisdiction is in compliance with the standards which are contained within that broad notion of the presumption of innocence. And what one final thing that I want to say by way of introduction is that what the impact assessment made the point was that this has very practical implications, not only within member states, but between member states. And they pointed to the fact that, for example, that we've seen a number of cases where in the executing state for a European arrest warrant, the courts have refused, in effect, to execute the warrant because the court in the executing state was not satisfied that the person would, the subject of the arrest warrant, would actually receive a fair trial in the requesting state. And that was often centered around issues concerned with the presumption of innocence. So it has very practical consequences that there is not, if you like, sufficient agreement about the normative standards which are relevant to the presumption of innocence. So what about the scope of the directive? Well, first of all, the first thing to know about it is that it applies to natural persons and not to legal persons. Again, in the impact assessment, they said that there is a case to be made for the presumption of innocence applying to legal persons, or at least that there's a case to be made for European standards, but in effect, the time was not right. I think what they were saying is that it's too complicated to get into the question of the presumption of innocence for legal persons, so we're going to confine the directive to natural persons, and that's exactly what happened in the directive itself. And as you can see there, the provisions of the directive apply at all stages of criminal proceedings, from the moment when a person is suspected or accused of having committed a criminal offence. So the, if you like, the starting point is a little bit different from some of the other directives, most of the other directives, which make the starting point, the point at which a person is informed by the competent authorities that they are a suspect or accused. But it follows from the nature of the presumption of innocence that it should apply not only from that moment when a person is informed that they are a suspect or accused, but must start as soon as they are a suspect or accused person. So we have in Article 3 the presumption of innocence, the general statement, which is the equivalent of Article 6.2 of the European Convention on Human Rights. Suspects and accused persons are presumed innocent until proved guilty according to law. As I say, a commonly accepted international standard around the world. But what the directive does is to divide that into four parts, really. Firstly, a prohibition on public references to guilt prior to a person being found guilty. Secondly, and that's in Article 4, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Secondly, measures regarding the public presentation of suspects or accused people, essentially requiring that people who have not been found guilty should not be presented as being guilty. It also, in Article 6, has a provision regarding the burden of proof, and in Article 7, a provision on the right to silence and the right of a person not to incriminate themselves. So I'll just quickly go through those various provisions. You'll have to forgive me for speeding through some of this, but that's a result of the time that we have available for it, and I'm looking at two directives, but you have my PowerPoint there in your materials, and hopefully you might find that of some use at a later date. So, first of all, we have the provisions regarding public references to guilt. And as we see in that first bullet point, that member states must take necessary measures to ensure that public statements made by public authorities and judicial decisions other than on guilt do not refer to a person as guilty where they have not been proved guilty according to law. And in the impact assessment, they supported the idea that this actually is not respected in practice by citing the fact that there have been cases at the European Court of Human Rights in respect of France, Lithuania, Belgium, Spain, Romania. And so Although it's there in the European Convention, it gives rise to problems. And they're problems of practice, because it's very easy to subscribe in principle to the notion of the presumption of innocence, but the question always really is how that's translated into practice. And one of the cases that they refer to is a case called Galicki versus Poland. And this involved a cardiac surgeon who was arrested just as he was about to start an operation. And he was arrested by 12 masked, armed police officers. That would not be prevented by either the convention or the directive in itself, but this operation was carried out by the Polish Central Anti-Corruption Bureau, and the head of that bureau then made statements to the press, which included this: Mr. Galicki is a ruthless and cynical bribe taker. We have knowledge of several dozen bribes accepted by the doctor. And this was following his arrest, but before any question of any trial having taken place. And so there we have a fairly extreme example of a public authority making a statement that a person is guilty before any court had made any judgment about whether he was guilty. And quite clearly, he actually did not succeed in his application at the European Court of Human Rights because he had not exhausted domestic remedies. But nevertheless, the court made it absolutely clear that that kind of conduct is contrary to Article 6.2, and it would be contrary to Article 4 of the directive as well. The directive goes on to provide that this prohibition on making public references to guilt is without prejudice to the prosecution being able to do things like draft and publish an indictment. They could, of course, still do things like that. And it also, the third bullet point, it does not prevent public authorities from publicly disseminating information on proceedings where this is strictly necessary. So, for example, if they are aware that a crime has been committed, but they have not been able to detain anyone for it, then this provision of the directive would not prevent the law enforcement authorities from putting out public information which perhaps gives a description or even a name of this person as being wanted in connection with a particular suspected offence. Although, again, in doing so, they would not be permitted to say that this person is guilty of it, but merely that they are wanted or they're suspected, etc. And then we have a provision in Article 5 about the presentation of suspects and accused people, which prohibits them from being presented as being guilty in court or in public by the use of, it's very specific, by physical restraint measures. So what it would prevent is suspects or defendants being routinely handcuffed or routinely in court being placed in a glass box or a cage. Or in leg irons. I don't know. Is there any country here where people are put in leg irons? No, my God. But, okay. So it would prevent that being routinely done, but as we see there, it would not prevent the use of physical restraint where this is necessary, where it's strictly necessary for case-specific reasons relating to security, etc. So the use of physical restraints such as handcuffs would be permissible, but they would have to be related to the specific circumstances of that particular case relating to that particular person. It could not be routinely done. And I guess that's going to require some changes of practice, and indeed law, but some changes in practice in some European jurisdictions where people are routinely handcuffed, for example. And I think just to make a link, we could link some of these provisions to pretrial detention in particular, because I've recently been engaged in some research looking at pretrial detention in 10 different EU jurisdictions. And one of the common features was that in many countries, in making decisions about pretrial detentions, judges quite often, in effect, assumed that the person was guilty, and they would deny the person being released, or they would order their detention in effect on the basis of, for example, the seriousness of the alleged offence. Now, the seriousness of the alleged offence can be a relevant factor, but it cannot be a reason in itself for keeping a person in custody prior to trial, because that would in effect imply an assumption that the person is guilty of that offence. So when in your respective countries the authorities are looking at this directive, then one of the things that they will need to consider is, well, how does this relate to the way in which we treat pretrial detention and the way in which judges make decisions and express the reasoning for their decisions about pretrial detention. Burden of proof, burden of establishing guilt must be on the prosecution, and it goes on to say, this is in Article 6, that any doubt as to the question of guilt must be to the benefit of the suspect or accused person. Now, it seems to me that does not prevent the standard of proof being having to be beyond reasonable doubt, which is a standard adopted in many jurisdictions. That would still be possible. So that particular provision is saying that doubt must be resolved to the benefit of the suspect or the accused, but that does not necessarily mean that any doubt would have to result in their acquittal. And we see there that it goes on to say that this is without prejudice to any obligation of the judge or court to seek both inculpatory and exculpatory evidence, and to the right of the defence to submit evidence in accordance with national law. Now, the right to silence and the right not to incriminate oneself, I mean, we could spend the whole afternoon on this particular subject, and I'm going to spend 2 minutes. And the reason for that is that although it's easy to say at a normative level that a person has the right to silence, the questions surrounding that normative proposition are quite complex, both in principle and in practice. So, for example, we heard earlier that in my own jurisdiction, the fact that a person remains silent, the fact that at the police station a person does not tell the police about facts which they subsequently rely on in their defence, strictly speaking, cannot be treated as evidence of guilt, but it can be treated as evidence that the defendant has no innocent explanation. The theory being that had they had an innocent explanation, they would have told the police about it. Now, I have to say that I was quite against that legislation when it came in 1994. It's there. We've had it since 1994, this possibility of adverse inferences from silence. And the directive would not prevent those kinds of evidential rules or rules of proof from applying. I think, and Taru mentioned this earlier on, that this is that the right to silence in practice is highly problematic. For example, the directive says nothing about what kind of pressure can be placed upon a suspect to waive their right to silence. And in the Netherlands, for example, the police have effectively official guidance which enables them to place suspects on under quite a high degree of pressure. One case in the research that we did stands out, where a man had been arrested on suspicion of sexual assault. He was some kind of therapist, and it was an accusation of sexual assault on a patient. And on the second day of his interviewing, he said, He said to the officers, look, he said, when I started yesterday, when you started questioning me, you told me I had a right to silence. And ever since, you've tried to take it away from me. And that really, I thought, sort of brought home in a very graphic way one of the problems with the right to silence is that the fact is that the police in many countries don't treat it as a right. Or if they do treat it as a right, it's a right which they will do their damnedest to upset and get round. And it seems to me that courts in many countries will allow that to happen. And another thing in relation to that which sticks in my mind was an interview with a French lawyer who said, look, you've got to understand that the right to silence is a fake right. He said, because if one of my clients exercises their right to silence, it follows them all the way through. And we see this. If someone exercises their right to silence, it is quite likely to affect whether they get released pending trial. If they exercise their right to silence, it is something that the judge, or in my jurisdiction, the jury, will know about. That's why the French lawyer concluded that it was a fake right. And yet, the European Court of Human Rights says it's one of the fundamental rights and respected around the world. Well, yes, in principle it is, in practice it is not. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this part of the directive is going to work in practice. Moving on then very quickly to the right to be present at trial. So this is the next major part. So we've got the presumption of innocence and then the right to be present at trial. I'll deal with this very briefly. So it essentially provides in Article 8 that an accused person has a right to be present at their trial, subject to two possibilities. One is if they fail to attend their trial, having been given timely notice of their trial, then they lose their right, and it means that the court is permitted to go on and make a judgment about whether they are guilty. Or secondly, if they are represented by a mandated lawyer who may be appointed either by the accused or by the state. Now, that doesn't mean the state can simply get round the prohibition, can get round the right to be present by simply appointing a state lawyer, because they must be mandated by, so in effect, they must be mandated by the accused, must be instructed by the accused, even though they might be appointed by the state. But nevertheless, the point is that the overall right is for the accused to be present at their trial, but it's possible for the trial to continue in their absence in those two particular circumstances. However, if a trial, this is slightly contradictory actually in Article 9, but if a trial does nevertheless go ahead in the absence of the accused, even though neither of those conditions was satisfied, then the accused, if they are convicted, must have a right to a new trial. So, but just to be clear, that only applies if those conditions, if I just go back a moment, that only applies, the right to a new trial only applies if one or either of those conditions was not applicable. If it was applicable and the trial proceeded in their absence, then under the directive they don't have a right to a new trial. But if it wasn't applicable and a trial nevertheless goes ahead, then they have a right to a new trial. And then we have various provisions I'm not going to go through because of the time, about there being adequate remedies, which I think, again, in practice is quite a difficult one. In Recital 44, for example, it says that the remedy should, as far as possible, have the effect of placing the suspect or accused in the position they would have been had there been no breach of the directive. But that will require careful thought about, well, what kind of remedies would be appropriate. You know, if you think about, let's say, if we go back to the Garlicky case, we have, let's supposing the head of the police investigation did publicly say that they were guilty, what is an appropriate remedy? Does it mean that the person has to be found not guilty, or could there be some other kind of remedy? Fortunately, I don't have time to go into that because I'm not clear what an appropriate remedy would be, but clearly state authorities are going to have to think about that very carefully. And then there's a provision about monitoring of the directive and data collection. So very rapidly, I'm going to move on to the second directive on procedural safeguards for children. And one of the things I meant to put on one of the slides was that there was a very comprehensive study carried out, I think, by people at Maastricht University on interrogating young suspects, where they both looked at procedural safeguards from a legal perspective, that's volume one, and the second one was looking at safeguards from an empirical perspective. And what the study went on to do was to develop a set of guidelines for effective protection of children in police in police interrogations. And that, if you're involved in this area, would be certainly worth looking at. And if you want the precise citation, then do speak to me afterwards and I can give it to you. So, as I said, it was adopted on the 11th of May this year. Transposition date is some time away on the 11th of June 2019. What is the size of the problem? Well, the impact assessment for this directive estimated that something like 12% of all those who face criminal proceedings in Europe, in the EU, are children. So that's a very significant number. It's in the hundreds of thousands. So about 12% of all people who face criminal proceedings are children. What I should say the directive does not do is that it does not say anything about the age of criminal responsibility. Initially, I think it was thought that it might be possible to get agreement on what should be the minimum age of criminal responsibility, but this is so varied across Europe that I think at a very early stage it was agreed that it would not be possible to get agreement on any common standard for the minimum of age of criminal responsibility, and therefore that issue has been avoided, and of course therefore it's left to member states to continue to determine what the minimum age of criminal responsibility should be. Just before I say a little bit about the various provisions, originally under the roadmap, the procedural rights roadmap, it was envisaged that there would be a directive both which covered both children and vulnerable suspects and defendants. And again, I think at an early stage, it was concluded that it would be very difficult to have common standards in the form of a directive regarding vulnerable suspects and defendants, partly because, again, across different EU states, quite different attitudes are taken to what amounts to vulnerability. So it was quite clear that there was some agreement that a person who is mentally disordered would be treated as vulnerable. But as soon as you moved away from, if you like, strict psychiatric categories of vulnerability, then it became much more difficult to see that there would be agreement across Europe. So, for example, in some jurisdictions, women who are pregnant are dealt with as being vulnerable or have some degree of procedural protection, whereas in others, like my own jurisdiction, there's no mention of that anywhere in any part of our relevant legislation. So, as a result of that, vulnerable people other than children were not included in this directive, but there is a commission recommendation on procedural protections for vulnerable suspects and accused people. The recommendation, being a recommendation, means it's not binding, but nevertheless, it's a very instructive document, and if that's something that you are concerned about and you are not aware of it, then certainly worth looking at the commission recommendation concerning procedural safeguards for vulnerable suspects and accused people. So the directive on safeguards for children, what's the purpose of it? Well, this, I think the best sort of description of its purpose is set out in recital one of the directive. So the purpose of the directive is to establish procedural safeguards to ensure that children, which means people under the age of 18 years, who are suspects or accused persons in criminal proceedings, are able to understand and follow those proceedings and to exercise their right to a fair trial, and also in order to prevent children from reoffending and to foster their social integration. So it's quite a big objective, a big purpose here, a laudable purpose for the directive to try to achieve. One of the issues is, and we faced this, we talked about this in relation to language, is, well, how do you determine the age of a child? You know, we talked about how do you determine whether someone does have a language difficulty. There's a similar issue, in principle, at least, with, well, how do you determine whether someone is a child? And that is covered partly by recital 13, which says that the age of a child should be determined on the basis of the child's own statement, or the person's own statement, because we don't know whether they're a child, checks of their civil status, documentary research, and other evidence. And it goes on to say, and if such evidence is not available, and as a last resort, by medical examination. So that's what recital 13 says. But in the directive itself, article 3 says, if there is uncertainty as to whether the person has reached the age of 18 years, they shall be presumed to be a child. And I think that's an important, it's a bit like with lack of facility in terms of language, that there should be a presumption which forces the authorities to err on the side of caution. And that should be true both in terms of language facility and in terms of whether someone is a child. So what's the scope of the directive? Well, it applies to children who are suspects or accused persons in criminal proceedings until sentence and any appeal. And just to note that this is a little bit different from, for example, the directive on the right to information, because it's not limited to those who have been notified by the competent authorities that they are a suspect or accused. So it applies if they are, if you like, as a matter of fact, a suspect or an accused person, whether or not the point has been reached at which they are formally notified that they are a suspect or an accused person. And it applies in criminal proceedings, the directive applies in criminal proceedings, and it applies to requested persons under a European arrest warrant. In respect of that category of people, of children, not all of the provisions of the directive apply, but nearly all of them do. So broadly speaking, it applies both in criminal proceedings and in European arrest warrant proceedings in respect of the execution of the warrant. And the other thing in terms of the scope is that there is a similar minor offences exception to the one that we saw in the directive on interpretation and translation. It's not quite identical. I won't go into the ways in which it's different, but it's very similar to the minor offences exception that I talked about this morning. Okay, so that's the scope. Let's just briefly, in the 5 minutes or so I have, let's have a quick look at, so what procedural safeguards is it referring to? Well, first of all, we have the right to information. So a child, suspect or accused person, must be informed about their rights. They are, of course, covered by the EU directive on the right to information, so they must be provided with information about those rights which the directive that you were hearing about earlier requires, and also they must be promptly informed about the rights under the directive. Now, what rights they have to be informed about actually does differ depending upon the stage of the proceedings. And again, I'm not going to go into the detail of that, but just to be aware that it's not just a blanket requirement that a child suspect or accused is informed at the beginning of the process. There are various parts of the obligation to provide information which apply, in effect, as the process develops. And, which I've said there, the point at which information is to be provided varies. But in the case of a child, the letter of rights, which you heard about in the previous session, must include not only those things which are set out in the directive on the right to information, but also must set out those things which are dealt with under this directive as well. So clearly there will have to be a different letter of rights for children as compared to adults. And then there is provision about notifying a person who has parental responsibility. So we see there at the first bullet point that information that must be given to a child, which I referred to just now under Article 4, must also be given to the person who, or a person who holds parental responsibility. And that must be given as soon as possible. There is an exception to that provision if there would be, let's say in broad terms, a problem with giving it to a parent. Take an easy example. If a child and a parent are both suspected of a criminal offence, then in those circumstances, the directive provides that the information can be given not to that parent, who's also a suspect, but to some other appropriate adult. And that's there in Article 5 and Recitals 22 to 24. And then I think quite an important... A very important provision is that under Article 15, that children have the right to be accompanied by that person who holds parental responsibility or other appropriate adult during court hearings and other stages of the process at which the child is present. And that would include police interrogations. That's something which is already standard practice in a number of jurisdictions, my own included. In my own jurisdiction, police interrogations, broadly speaking, cannot take place in the absence of an appropriate adult. And I know that that's also true in some other jurisdictions, and that's there in the directive. There are some exceptions to that, which I'm not going to go into, but that's the broad obligation. And then we come to the right to a lawyer. And, well, we already know, and it's something we're talking about tomorrow, aren't we? Yes, about the right of access to a lawyer, covered by that EU directive 2013/48. So this is, in one sense, a reinforcement of the right to a lawyer under that directive, which we're going to be looking at tomorrow. But, in effect, in relation to children, it's not simply a right of access to a lawyer, it's a mandatory obligation to provide a lawyer. So, as we see, they must ensure, member states must ensure that children are assisted. Not that they have a right of access to, they have an obligation to ensure that children are assisted by a lawyer without undue delay once they are made aware that they are a suspect or accused person. And it also provides... for example, that generally a police, I'm just checking, yeah, that a police interrogation should not go ahead of a child in the absence of a lawyer, or at least until they've spoken to a lawyer. Now, there is provision for derogation. I'm not going to go through that in any detail, you'll be glad to hear, but just to note that there is provision for derogation from that provision. But nevertheless, so the broad provision is that legal assistance is mandatory for children, subject to those possible exceptions. And that raises interesting questions in relation to legal aid, because what Article 18 says is that member states shall ensure that national law in relation to legal aid guarantees the effective exercise of the right to be assisted by a lawyer. Well, as I've just said, it's more than simply a right to be assisted. It's an obligation that they are assisted. And the question that I raise, and I'm just raising it, not seeking to resolve it, is that under the Legal Aid Directive, as we will hear tomorrow, member states will be permitted to apply a means test. And there's no special provision in the Legal Aid Directive as regards children. And so I just raise this question, and maybe it won't be a real question in practice, it won't be problematic in practice, but whether it could or should be possible for a member state to apply a means test to a person, being a child, who is required to have a lawyer. That would seem to me to be, there's certainly quite a degree of conflict there, that you force someone to have a lawyer, but then say you've got to pay for them. Although actually we already see that in some jurisdictions with adults, like in Italy. But I think that is problematic. And of course it may be that member states, given that they've got to ensure that national law means that the right to a lawyer is effective, it seems to me that it would be very difficult for a member state then to have a means test for a child, because then they're not ensuring that it's effective for those children who might have means, financial means. I can deal very quickly with the last few things. We have a provision which is that children must be individually assessed to ensure that their specific needs concerning protection, education, training, and social integration are taken into account. And we also have a provision which says that children have a right to medical examination. So this is not something that would happen automatically, but they have a right to medical examination, which could be, in effect, implemented by them. The person having parental responsibility would be another person who could ensure or start the process of ensuring that they do have a medical examination if that's necessary. And then an interesting one again, although we see it gives a lot of discretion to member states, but that children, questioning of children must be audio-visually recorded. But, as you see, where this is proportionate in the circumstances of the case. And one of the things I was going to say earlier on in relation to the right to information, that I think from the research that I've conducted and my experience in my own jurisdiction, that one of the things that really changed how things worked in my own country was the fact of police interrogations being electronically recorded, although ours are still normally only audio recorded. But because I think, and I can't prove this from research, but I think that what happened before was that courts would routinely shut their eyes to what was probably improper conduct on the part of the police. And once the court was presented with an audio recording, which in effect they could be forced to play in court, they could no longer hide their eyes. And I'm just thinking in relation to the Netherlands, for example, because I said earlier on that we found that the police may well use improper pressure to try to force a person to waive their right to silence. I wonder, once that is all electronically recorded, whether it would continue to be possible for the courts simply to say, that's okay, we don't mind that kind of pressure that you're exerting. We'll have to see how that goes. But in relation to children, normally interrogation should be audio-visually recorded under this directive, as I say, but subject to that condition that it is proportionate in the circumstances of the case. And then, very quickly, there are provisions in the directive on the deprivation of liberty. I've described them in my notes as being aspirational because it gives member states such a large degree of discretion, and indeed the judiciary within member states. If we just take the first one, Article 10, deprivation of liberty must be limited to the shortest appropriate period. Well, what is the shortest appropriate period? Well, of course, the directive does not say what is meant by the shortest appropriate period, and therefore that's open to a lot of interpretation by judges and the police, etc. And so I describe that as being an aspirational standard. That's not to say it's wrong. I think it's absolutely right that it's there, but it is an aspirational standard. And that's true of the second one. Where possible, appropriate authorities must have recourse to measures alternative to detention. Well, we already, in relation to pretrial detention, we already have such a provision coming such a standard coming from the European Court of Human Rights. So it's good that it's there, but of course it's open to a lot of interpretation within member states. And then where deprived of their liberty, children must normally be held separately from adults. There are a series of other provisions which I'm not going to go into because of the time that we have available. So we have just very briefly there the fact that proceedings involving children should be dealt with speedily. Privacy of children must be respected. Children have a right to be present at trials, which is also, of course, covered by the directive that I was talking about first of all. But I think just point out there that it says that member states must take all necessary measures to enable them to participate effectively. And that, in part, comes from cases decided by the European Court of Human Rights, one of which came from the UK, Thompson and Venables, where those two children who were about 11 years of age, 10 and 11, I believe, who were prosecuted for murder, were confronted by our judges with their wigs on, sitting up on the bench up there, and their barrister with their wig and their gown. It's intimidating for an adult. And as a result of the European Court decision, changes had to be made and were made. But that's the kind of thing at the extreme that this part of the directive is talking about, that the proceedings must be conducted in such a way that the child, as far as possible, can effectively participate. And then we have provisions about effective remedies and appropriate training. So I'll finish at that point.